This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. World War II was America's first war covered on the radio.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid siren. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance, one single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue.
And that was Edward R. Murrow, perhaps the most recognizable news voice of World War II. Retired Northern Kentucky University professor Michael Turney recently gave a lecture called On the Air, How Radio and Media Coverage Shaped the Second World War. Dr. Turney is joining us in the studio to discuss the topic. You can join our conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100 or email talk at WVXU.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Dr. Turney, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And full disclosure, I have a degree from Northern Kentucky University, and Dr. Turney was the chairperson of the Department of Communications when I got my degree in radio television.
Is that right?
And
that
we haven't aged a bit in 25 years.
Well, you look a little more mature, but I haven't.
Again, thanks for being here. If you to start out, sort of describe the radio landscape around the 1940s. We're going to talk about World War II, but just tell us, you know, what was radio like in the 1940s?
Well, I think the really important thing for people, particularly for younger generations, to understand is that radio at that time was dramatically different than it is today. For one thing, FM radio didn't exist, so we wouldn't have been on the air back then. Right now, the greater Cincinnati metropolitan area has at least 41 radio stations that are available to people who are tuned in here, just listening to radio over the air. That doesn't even count the internet radio options. And truthfully, that 41 is probably an underestimate, because it doesn't include stations that may be in Columbus or Indianapolis or some of the other surrounding areas that you can pick up with a good radio here. In the 1930s, the late 30s and the early 40s, there were 5 radio stations in Cincinnati. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. And several of those stations went off the air at dusk, so they were only on daytime hours. It was totally, totally different.
And they were largely entertainment-oriented, musicals, entertainment shows. The news content was minimal at best.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, all of that entertainment was predominantly live entertainment. So there were dramas, there were comedies, as you mentioned, there was live music, there were bands, there were symphony orchestras, there was no recorded music at all, and news was, on a lot of stations, totally non-existent. Other stations might have accounted for 5% of their total airtime. But the other thing, and again, this is one of the paradoxes, there were a few stations around the country where news was a big deal, and they did a good job of covering it. But there were others where there was absolutely no news. And then there were stations where what they called news and put on the air as news was really just an announcer reading the headlines from the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, this sounds like it's made up. It sounds like a joke, but it really happened. There were frequently would be announcements on one of these kind of radio stations. I'm sorry, we won't have news today. Our paper wasn't delivered.
And I know, you talk about these 5 stations, And it's probably not a good example for WVXU listeners because we're affiliated with a network that we still carry a lot of network programming. But these early stations, they were usually tied to a major national network for their programming.
It would here again, it was a mix. Of the five stations in Cincinnati, three of them were indeed associated with a national network. Two were not. And what's really surprising, you know, to people who know a little bit about radio history or even the way radio is today, WLW Radio, which in most people's minds today is tremendously associated with the NBC network, WLW Radio was not a network affiliate in those early days. It was a big enough standalone station that they went their own way and they actually competed head-to-head with the networks for programming.
So when World War II happened, I know today in our media landscape, you know, it's who was first? Who was the first to get there? Who decided, okay, let's talk about this on the radio. Let's go cover it.
Well, actually, what really happened, and we have to step back a few years, you know, we step back to the mid-1930s, and if you look at the national landscape in radio, NBC was huge. At that point, NBC was operating two separate networks.
Red and blue.
You got it.
There you go. That's right.
See, those glasses paid off.
All right.
And one of them, I'm going to show off, one of them became ABC, which I think was blue.
Right. Absolutely. Actually, and it was in the middle of the war that the Supreme Court finally ordered that spinoff to happen. But in the mid-30s, NBC was, because of having those two networks, NBC was an entertainment powerhouse. NBC had contracts with all of the big-name entertainers. I can't say all, but most. They were kicking butt over at CBS. So CBS president William Paley said, you know, we've got to do something to establish ourselves. So in the mid-1930s, CBS made a commitment that they were going to become the news network. They were going to emphasize news, and that's what would make their mark. And they set out and started to do that. And they hired some people. They hired people away from the newspapers. They hired people away from the wire services, and they started putting news on the air. So CBS has to get CBS in general and as a network has to get a whole lot of credit. And then Edward R. Murrow, whose clip you ran at the opening of our segment, he built broadcast journalism. I mean, he was just incredible and phenomenal in terms of the impact that he had. And I mean, it's kind of ironic that you opened the show with that clip. I mean, in some ways, it's fabulous because as an example of great, great broadcasting. I mean, the drama there, covering an air raid live, is just super. But that was not what early radio coverage was like. That was really the exception.
What I wondered. Was it more? It wasn't live at the beginning.
That's right. Well, and what it was, I mean, the news coverage early on was basically a news reader, and a lot of places used that term. The news reader sitting in the studio would read the stories, and there would be one person, and that was it. Murrow's situation was unique. Some of it was pure dumb luck, okay? Murrow was operating from London. He had been sent to London by CBS basically to book celebrities on the air. And he was there when the war began. And his studio, the building his studio was housed in, was right at Trafalgar Square. And when the Battle of Britain started, that was one of the key places that was being bombed. So Murrow, basically, from his radio studio, he took a microphone with a long cord on it and went up and stood on the roof and reported live while the bombs were dropping. But the only reason he could do that was because of where the studio was. He couldn't have, if some other part of the city had been being bombed, he couldn't have covered it live.
I think about that, you know, what I've got in my reporter's kit when I go out now. I have, you know, a handheld a recording device that has a little flash card similar to what's in your digital camera. I have my smartphone here on my side. I have my laptop that I can connect to a wireless network. They had very little technology when this was taking place, when World War II started.
At the beginning, they had virtually none. I mean, the technology they had was in the studio, and it was huge transmitters full of vacuum tubes. I mean, weighed hundreds and hundreds of pounds. There was no portable equipment that you could haul around at all. There was no easy-to-use recording equipment that you could haul around. I mean, they were tied to a studio. Or their idea of on-the-scene reporting, you know, somebody might be able to run across town to see what was happening, and then they'd drive back to the studio, they'd rush up the stairs and say, well, let me tell you what I just saw.
And this, you know, where he was at in London was connected to the United States essentially via a huge wire that runs on the ocean floor between the two countries.
Absolutely.
Where we take advantage of satellites today, there were no satellites.
That's right. It was transatlantic cable.
In a press release, like I said, you gave a lecture on this. There was a press release sent out talking about it. There was a line in there, radio became the preferred source for up-to-the-minute news, but most continued to rely on newspapers for further details and most routine news coverage.
Right.
Explain that.
Well, basically, prior to the war, newspapers were the news medium. I mean, everybody relied upon their newspapers. And early in the war, even, you know, many of the newscasters, when they did their broadcasts, you know, they were basically, as I mentioned earlier, they were providing headlines. And they knew they were providing headlines, and they told people they were providing headlines. Some of them would even encourage people to go out and get the newspaper to read the rest of the story. Some of which was because there were some big radio stations that were actually owned by newspapers, and they were using the station to promote the newspaper. I mean, probably the biggest and best known was WGN Radio in Chicago. I mean, the WGN call letters ostensibly stand for World's Greatest Newspaper.
Yeah. Murrow, I mean, he was in London. Did he help then build this network of reporters throughout Europe during the war? And is that what started then news bureaus internationally for the United States media outlets?
Well, yes and no. Murrow definitely built the broadcast team that covered Europe. He hired all of the key people. Okay. One of the interesting things is that most of the people he hired were print reporters. Most of them had been working for United Press, which was a news service, an international news service that was already working but was geared to newspapers. So he went and hired a big chunk of their staff away. People like Howard K. Smith and Charles Collingwood, you know, names that we recognize today that we associate.
One name that obviously is tied with CBS is Walter Cronkite, but he did not cover World War II for CBS.
That's right. Yeah. But now, here again, one of those really interesting stories. Walter Cronkite was also a United Press correspondent. He was based in London, but he was assigned to cover all of Europe. So he traveled throughout Europe. Yeah. When Edward R. Murrow was out trying to hire people, he approached Cronkite. He tried to hire him several times, and Cronkite turned him down flat. And this really became a bone of contention.
Is that what? Because they had a pretty frosty relationship, and that's the reason.
That's exactly the reason. There was that antagonism that lasted long afterwards. So Cronkite stayed with United Press through the war and didn't get into broadcasting actually until the 1950s. At that point, he did go to work for CBS, but it specifically was for CBS television. So Cronkite started not as a radio person, but as a TV newsman.
You know, when people in the United States started hearing reports like reporters actually in the invasion at Normandy, that must have had a tremendous impact on people, that, you know, actually hearing those sounds of war for the first time. Did it change public attitudes, or?
You know, that's something that really has not been fully analyzed yet. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of surprising that it hasn't been looked into. You know, we heard, you know, long after the Second World War, when we start talking about the Vietnam War, we hear a lot about Vietnam being the first television war, right, and the impact of Vietnam coverage coming into our living rooms. So we've heard lots and lots of the psychology of that. But World War II really has not been thoroughly analyzed in that respect. But you're right, Howard. I mean, the impact had to have been phenomenal, because that was such a dramatic change for people to be hearing, as you say, the sounds of battle, to be getting the news as it was happening. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It was certainly mind-boggling to people in those days. I mean, and if I talk to people, you know, my mother and people of her generation, you know, who lived through the war, I mean, they can talk about some of those things.
A couple of things here before we run completely out of time. That radio, the line there where radio became the preferred source for Up to Minute, people still relied on newspapers for their continuing coverage.
Right.
How would you phrase that today? Is it TV and social media? Is it social media and TV? How does that work today?
So you know, definitely the internet and social media are coming into first place. I mean, TV had been dominant for a couple of decades, but social media are definitely starting to displace TV as the up-to-the-minute instant news information. But then, you know, people who want more information after they see something on social media, you know, they probably won't even go to TV now. They'll probably just go further into the internet and do some online searching and pull stuff up that way.
We talk about the legacy of Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. What would they think of today's media landscape?
That's pure, you know, speculation.
Yeah. Well, speculation.
But I guess I have to think they would be very, very disappointed. And truthfully, I mean, as a journalism professor, I'm kind of disappointed too in what I see, because I think we have lost the distinction that used to be very clearly made between factual news coverage and opinion and commentary. There's so much commentary, there's so much personalization in the news now that it's totally changed from what it was in their days.
We appreciate you being here to talk about it.
This was fun.
Yeah, thank you.
We've been talking about radio news coverage during the Second World War and how it helped shape today's As It Happens approach to news. Our guest was retired Northern Kentucky University professor Michael Turney. And thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We appreciate you having this discussion with us each day. We'd also like to get your thoughts on the show. Please go to WVXU.org and take part in our listener survey. Archives of our programs are also available on our website. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Bruce Ellis. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.